5AP 2202 CR, State versus House. And arguing on behalf of Mr. is Michael Steinle. We will then hear for 30 minutes from Juan Colas, and then 5 minutes from Mr. Steinle in rebuttal. So,
may it please the court. My name is Michael Steinle. I represent Jeffrey House in this matter. And I know that you understand the facts, but I think I have to at least give a little procedural history in the facts of this case. Is that in March of 2004, the Milwaukee HIDTA unit, and they're a specialized unit in Milwaukee County. And what it is it's a government agency consisting of state and federal prosecutors and state and federal agents, both police department and members of the DEA, FBI, ATF. They have groups of people, and we call them the HIDTA units. It's called High Intensity Drug Enforcement Agencies, and they get their money from the federal government. And what they've been doing lately is they've been getting wiretaps, but most of their wiretaps have been coming out of the federal government. And for whatever reason, the Milwaukee HIDTA decided to go to the state court this time and do this. And this same group of
state officers get, or the county officers get their wiretap from the feds?
Yes.
Is that what you're telling us?
Traditionally, and we've had a lot of wiretaps in federal court, and I do a lot of federal court action. It's hard to not get a conspiracy in federal court now, out of at least the Eastern District of Wisconsin, where there's not a wiretap anymore. But for whatever reason, this group of people, which is both state and federal prosecutors, and the prosecutors in the Milwaukee HIDTA unit are deputized as a U.S. attorney, so they have, if you will, concurrent jurisdiction. They can take the case federally or they can take it state. It's their discretion is what it is.
Now, and let me ask you, counsel, when I read the 40 or 50-page complaint, which was in the appendix, it seemed that most of the people involved here were, quote, Wisconsin residents, if not all. I mean, they were primarily centered in Milwaukee and around the two businesses. Are you saying that it is unusual when they're primarily Wisconsin residents for a wiretap?
Yes, because under federal law, in order to get jurisdiction, we just have to show that it's coming from outside of our district, basically. And obviously, cocaine isn't manufactured or grown in the state.
Well, there was also heroin and ecstasy here.
Correct. And it's all being exported is what it is. And usually what happens is it's the center, the target of this investigation was a man by the name of Sammy Caraballo. And Sammy Caraballo was what they alleged is a large-scale cocaine ecstasy dealer in the Milwaukee area. What they did is they applied for the original wiretap and got a 30-day wiretap because that's what the statute allows. And then they got two extensions, so that this was actually a 90-day wiretap is what it was. And in this case is my client, Jeffrey House, is on this tape, which is hundreds and hundreds of conversations over 90 days.
Thousands of conversations.
Well, probably.
Because there were conversations with one party, I think it was pointed out over 1,000 times.
Correct.
Just one of the individuals.
Correct. And I think what happens is these telephones that these, if you will, drug dealers are using is they're talking on this phone hundreds of times a day, I guess is a fair way to put it. But my client was only on the wiretap for this 90 days 5 times. And out of those 5 times, he negotiated 3 grams of cocaine, purchased 3 grams of cocaine from the target, Sammy Caraballo, on 2 occasions. The other 3 calls have to do with follow-up calls with regard to those 2 transactions that they're talking about.
Your complaint here, or your argument, is basically that they used non-enumerated offenses, racketeering, money laundering. My question is this. In an organization, this seems to be, and I'm not an expert, but you read the complaint, there were literally dozens of people involved. There were businesses that were allegedly perhaps purchased with drug money. What is wrong with using non-enumerated when it would arise out of the enumerated incidents? In other words, you're dealing with drug dealing. You're dealing with people that are using, trying to perhaps launder the effect they don't want people to know where they got the money from. What, isn't this a natural outgrowth of that?
Yes, but why can't you go to federal court? The federal court statute, Title III, allows for that, and you can go into federal court and do that and get that same type of information. That is those are enumerated offenses under the Title 18 United States Code, I believe it's 1352 with regard to that. Why do you have to go to state court? Because our legislature, Your Honor, has indicated that you only can get it for eight different crimes in the conspiracy to do those eight crimes. And states are more restrictive in this as opposed to the federal government by including non-enumerated crimes within this. Aren't we broadening it? Then what's the difference between the state and the federal?
The state's argument is that they only use the enumerated. They did not use laundering. They did not use racketeering. Your client was convicted on the very statute that was enumerated in 968.
Correct. But my whole point is that the judge didn't have the authority to issue the order that he issued because he issued an order for something that the statute says that he can't issue it for.
Counselor, do you agree that there was probable cause to issue the order exclusive of any allegation of a non-statutory listed offense?
I do. I do. It's a valid order. But in this case is when you are including at least three things, and if you look at that racketeering that they included with regard to it, and then you check the racketeering statute with regard to it, the racketeering statute then incorporates another 100 crimes. So, again, aren't we broadening the whole concept of non-enumerated offenses by saying racketeering, and then if you look under 946.82, and racketeering activity means any activity specified in 18 United States 1961 and then proceeds to list 100 different crimes, if you will, if more than that, 100 different crimes. So by the mere fact of you inserting in your order a racketeering type of activity, and again, the legislature could have said that, conspiracy or racketeering, but the legislature, at least the Wisconsin legislature, specifically limited it to the eight crimes in the conspiracy to commit those eight crimes, not racketeering to commit them.
Counsel, isn't dealing in controlled substances broad enough to cover racketeering and money laundering? Don't those oftentimes go hand in hand?
Oftentimes they do, but we can have money laundering for other crimes. Anything, money laundering is nothing more than the accumulation of an asset or money or purchasing money with an illegal activity. So whether or not my illegal activity is somehow or another, let's say I'm not paying taxes on my money, so therefore I'm laundering the excess money that I'm doing that. So again, yes, to answer your question in a very broad sense, but if you look at it, is money laundering is more than just money laundering. You and I think in the common public, everybody perceives money laundering as money laundering of drug proceeds. But that's not true. Money laundering, technically under the federal statute and the state statute, is purchasing anything with illegal gains.
Well, you know, when I looked at the federal statute and the state statute, I saw that it was very different in structure, looking at the state statute as against the federal statute. And by that I mean the federal statute seems to tie into specific sections of the U.S. Code. The state statute does not, except for a computer crime. All the rest seems to be broad language, kidnapping, dealing with controlled substances, this type of thing. Isn't that significant in all of this?
I don't think so, because I take the opposite view of that, is that they're being more restrictive. The legislature said you can only have it for these eight crimes, and I don't know why they did that computer crimes and specifically listed the computer crimes. All I can say is that's probably a newer type of crime than the other ones that are listed, so therefore it was an inclusion after the fact, or with regard to... Also, at that time, 961 was 161, so they were changing, if you will, the criminal code at the same time, I believe, as this. So they wanted to list the crimes, is my argument, at least what the legislature did, and they intended to restrict it just to those crimes.
Is there a computer crime misdemeanor?
I don't know the answer to that, but I don't.
Because that's why they say felony there, whereas the others are all felonies under the statute as I understand it.
I can't imagine there is not a misdemeanor computer crime, but at the same time, again, I think that is more of a relatively new statute, and that's the only reason why I think that they included that. But if you look at the goal of Title III, it was to define a uniform.
I just want to follow up, and Justice Crooks, were you done?
I was just going to ask whether or not you couldn't look at the state statute and say that what the legislature was doing was painting with a much broader brush than what the U.S. Congress did in enacting the federal statute. Is there any legislative history that would tell us they were trying to narrow things rather than paint with a broad brush?
Well, I think under federal constitutional law, it has to be more restrictive. It can't be more broader, and that's one of my points that I'm making is it can't be broader. States have to be more restrictive than Title III. And I cite that in my brief and with regard to that. So if that's what they were trying to do, then they're wrong for doing that, and I think then obviously this court has to obviously address that issue. But that's my whole argument is that what the chief judge of Milwaukee County in this case did is by including the non-enumerated crimes, he has made the statute even broader than the federal one. And again, and the only reason why I put in that introduction is these are lawyers. These are trained people, U.S. attorneys and district attorneys working together in corroboration to form, if you will, this. I mean, I think there's some perception that the police officers are doing this. This isn't the police officers. These are very, very trained legal minds, probably some of the brightest, if you will, in the U.S. Attorney's Office and the District Attorney's Office making choices that we're going to go to federal court or state court. And if they want to include federal crimes and ask the state court to do it, then shame on them. I don't think that it is the state's responsibility to, if you will, investigate the federal crime. Then go to the federal court. And they're doing it on a daily basis. As I said, I think at any given time in the last 3 years, there isn't a time in Milwaukee County that they don't have a wiretap going on.
Counselor,
right now.
Doesn't the state court have jurisdiction to adjudicate federal crimes?
I think that there's a joint, if you will, jurisdiction under a lot of the statutes with regard to it. But in this case is that the people that applied for and asked for this warrant, and again, I raised this the argument, saying that it was defective in two ways. The first way was because under the original application that they got, they did get the Attorney General's permission and the District Attorney's permission with regard to it, and they signed off on consent. On each of the, if you will, the extensions, if you will, they did not do that. And Judge Kahn did throw out both extensions, the first 30-day extension and the second 30-day extension. He did follow my argument with regard to that. And I only mention that is because, in all honesty, I think that whoever drafted this, and again, the lawyers that did it are the ones that drafted it, and they're responsible for it. So to sit there, and this obviously goes into the state's argument of Leon, does Leon apply or not apply? No, because I think, in all honesty, you're not crossing your T's and you're not dotting your I's. You're just throwing something together is basically what you are, and you're asking a state court judge to approve it.
Well,
and that's not what Title III says you should do.
Counsel, as I understand your argument, the crimes that you're complaining about in your brief that should not have been included in this application included racketeering, continuing criminal enterprise, and money laundering. Now, my first question to you is, was there any evidence obtained as a result of the wiretap that went to any of those three violations?
You know, I don't know the complete answer to that 100%. Not to my client, no. So I can say that because I didn't listen to every single conversation. What you can do on these tapes is you can basically pump in your client's name, and through digital recordings, you can listen to your tape recorded game. So honestly, I did not listen to the thousands of telephone conversations.
And if there was no evidence that went towards your client with respect to the complaint of violations that were in the application, the ones that you say shouldn't have been in the application, then why should this court look at suppression as a remedy for the application if nothing went to those violations?
Because this case is going to stand, obviously, for the proposition of what other cases do in the future. And to not address that and say just because House, it doesn't apply to House in this case, no harm, no foul, that's not what we as lawyers or you as justices do. I think the remedy is, the statute specifically says that it is. It was actually patterned after the federal law, who actually has a statute with regard to it. And I think that, in all honesty, it's not necessarily this case that I'm here arguing for. I'm arguing for the next John Doe, next year, the 2 years or the 3 years, and the precedent-setting effect of this case, saying just because it didn't happen in this case doesn't mean that it's illegal.
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Robbery is not one of those things that you could seek a wiretap for, is it?
Correct.
But you indicated in response to Justice Rogenczyk there was probable cause for this order.
Yes.
All right. Now, let's suppose in the course of the taping, the police learned that there was going to be a robbery in Wautoma. On a particular day, what do they do with that information?
Well, again, that all goes to the issue of minimization with regard to wiretap law. If the statute, or whether it be the federal or the state, says that you're looking at these types of crimes, and what officers actually sit in a big room, and they literally 24/7, they're sitting in this room listening to these conversations. And then, let's say attorney Mike Steinle is talking to this individual, and he's talking about going up to Wautoma. Right away, minimization says that, in fact, you have to obviously not listen to the call. You have to turn it off because it's an attorney. The same thing is in theory, and what the law says is that they're supposed to minimize anything that's not in the order. So to answer your question, under the law, technically they're supposed to ignore that.
There's case law, though, that isn't there, that stands for the proposition that even though it may not be enumerated or an enumerated offense, that during the course of human events, when it becomes obvious that there's other criminal activity going on, is it your position that they are precluded under case law from following up on that?
I think so. I think what you have to do is you have to then go and get another order, a new application to the chief judge.
What about 968.29 subsection 5? Officer, while engaged in intercepting in a manner authorized, intercepts relating to offenses other than those specified, the contents may be disclosed under 1 and 2, which is to other law enforcement, and the contents and any evidence derived therefrom may be used under 3, which is giving testimony under oath, by going to the judge.
Yeah, I think
so. There's authorization, it seems to me, under the statute, where you pick up information that doesn't come under the statute authorizing. And you're saying here there's a wiretap for non-authorized crimes. This takes care of the event where you're dealing with unauthorized crimes if they're picked up by a valid authorization. So the back end of that might very well mean that warrants no good, the intercept is no good. That's your argument.
No, I don't think it was no good. I think in response to Justice Bradley, I think I said that they would have to go back to the judge and get an order. And I think if you read on to that statute, they're saying you have to get permission from the judge and a new order.
That's
so
right.
I think that's...
Counsel, I also want to follow up on a question started by Justice Rogenczyk and pursued by Justice Prosser, dealing with the issue of probable cause. The question, as I understood it by Justice Rogenczyk, is whether or not you were contesting there was probable cause as to the enumerated offenses, from your perspective, enumerated offenses, and you said you were not contesting that. Let me slice that question a little bit. Are you contesting or have you contested whether or not there's probable cause in this application, for instance, for the issuance of money laundering? Is that before us?
Maybe I don't understand the question. You mean, was there evidence obtained for money laundering
no.
in this case?
No. In order to get an authorization, an order for authorization, there has to be a finding of probable cause.
Correct.
The finding of probable cause is based on the application set forth here, this many-page
Correct.
Application. The question, as I understood it, was whether or not you were at all contesting that there was probable cause for the offenses as enumerated in the statute. And I heard you to say no.
Correct.
It's your argument. There are several offenses that are listed, but improperly so, because they are not enumerated in the statute. One of those offenses, of course, is money laundering. Are you contesting or raising the issue of whether or not there is probable cause in the application for money laundering?
No, I'm not, to answer that question, but the question begs what I started in the beginning. This order asked for money laundering in violation of 18 United States Code 1956 and 1957. So it asked for the federal money laundering statute. And that's my point, is that this judge had no authority to issue the order that he issued because it involved federal crimes, and they specifically said federal crimes.
I want to go back to Justice Crooks's question about how broad is dealing in drugs in the statute. This court has said that drug dealers ordinarily have guns, and certain kinds of firearms are criminal. You think that drug dealing would include an offense of that involved firearms?
Well, I think that if they heard on a wiretap that the person was armed in with cocaine, no, because it's with the cocaine. But to sit there and say that John Doe has a gun in his house and we know he's a convicted felon, so he's a felon in possession, I don't think they could do that without, again, going to the statute that you cited.
So your position is drug dealing means possession with intent to deliver or delivering.
Or a conspiracy to do that.
To do that, illegal substances.
Correct.
Not money laundering, not guns.
Not money laundering pursuant to 18 United States Code 1957 and 58. And that what they said is foreign travel and transportation in aid of racketeering in violation of 18 United States Code 1952. They're specifically saying, so again, just very briefly because my time is up, but it is creating a broader statute than the federal government
has. Let's assume for the moment that the court agrees with you that under the Wisconsin statute there's no authority to intercept for racketeering or money laundering as defined in the federal statutes. But the evidence here falls within the state statute for which an intercept can be made, correct?
It could, yes.
Okay. So what's your remedy? You, as I understand it, say, hey, that intercept order was just void and everybody goes home. Is that your position?
No, because any evidence derived from the wiretap, in these cases, it's not just the wiretap that's prosecuting these people. They have independent, usually controlled by search warrants. They have confidential informants testifying. So just because the wiretap goes to the side doesn't mean they can't prosecute.
You want to suppress anything from the wiretap?
Exactly.
I want to know what your remedy is.
From the wiretap only, yes.
Wiretap, because the wiretap was illegal because it was broader than the state statute. Is that the argument?
Yes, and it allowed him to intercept for crimes not enumerated.
Mr. Steinle, if I can follow up the Chief's question. You've argued that remedy in two portions of your brief on page 5 and on page 12, where you argue that interceptions unlawfully obtained or not made in conformity with the statute should have been suppressed pursuant to section 96830 sub 9. On page 12, you say that specifically provides for suppression as the remedy for communications intercepted pursuant to unlawful orders. Now, when I look at 96830 sub 9A, the statute provides for suppression on the grounds that the communication was unlawfully intercepted. Second, the order of authorization or approval under which it was intercepted is insufficient on its face, not unlawful, insufficient. And third, or the interception was not made in conformity with the order of authorization or approval. Now, which of those three prongs does this case fall under in your view?
The very first one, because the judge doesn't have the authority in order to issue that order. So the order is invalid.
Does it fall under the second at all, insufficient on its face?
Yes. I mean, you could make that argument saying that it's, but see, my argument is that it's otherwise valid. The mere fact that you have the non-enumerated crimes in it, obviously, is what I'm saying. He over-exercised his authority that the statute gave him.
Mm-hmm. And just see, the red light is on. You're taking the fact that because it wasn't there, it's a limitation. Justice Crooks asked about what he felt was possibly the broad language used in drug crimes, and you're saying, no, that is not broad. That is a narrow.
I'm asking the court to look at the statute and strictly interpret the statute is what I'm asking to.
Mr. Stein,
thank you.
Could I follow up on the Chief's question? Are you saying that the entire evidence obtained from the wiretap theoretically with respect to all 31 defendants should be suppressed?
I do, but I can tell the court my answer to that is that at least to my client, obviously that would help my client, but he was one of the minor participants. Most of the people in this have been convicted. Actually, only two went to jury trial. All of them pled guilty, and they all had independent evidence. That is, after the wiretap was over, they went and searched the houses. They found evidence of controlled substances and the like, and they had controlled buys from these people. They had investigative procedures of following these people. So they had so much evidence against these people that it was overwhelming. In this case, Jeff House, yes, to answer your question, if the wiretap's gone, they have nothing against Jeff House except these two conversations, basically, where he's asking for 3 grams of cocaine. So to answer your question, I don't think the other 30 defendants fall by the wayside or they can somehow jump on board and say that now their conviction is illegal because they had independent evidence of it.
Well, but would you say the wiretap evidence against some of these other defendants was harmless?
It wasn't harmless. It was cumulative. I mean, in the sense that they had so much overwhelming evidence against them otherwise, by informants, by control buys, by actual possession with the intent to deliver, such as Mr. Coffey, who actually went with me on this issue, and the two of us did. He tried his case, and they found him, the jury found him not guilty of the conspiracy, so that took care of the wiretap, but found him guilty of possession with the intent to deliver, and he's doing 12 years on that case specifically of just what was in his house.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Steinle, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Willis, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, Department of Justice, Counsel.
May it please the Court. The decision of the Court of Appeals in this case should be affirmed, first because in this case, racketeering and money laundering are components or actions in furtherance of dealing in controlled substances, which is an enumerated offense. And secondly,
well, what about guns? Is that a component of dealing in drugs?
There are, I think it would be factually dependent on whether the conversations relating to the weapons was in furtherance of dealing in controlled substances. In those circumstances, I think that it could be.
You have a different rule for racketeering and money laundering than dealing with guns?
I think one distinction that could be made in order to draw a narrower application of the principle that I'm arguing for is that racketeering and money laundering are offenses that are not crimes in themselves but require proof of predicate offenses. And whereas in this case, the only predicate offenses that are listed in the application that could possibly apply to racketeering and money laundering are the possession and delivery of controlled substances and conspiracy to do so, then I think that could provide a clear place to distinguish between other crimes and racketeering and money laundering.
Counsel, at the outset, and we're still at the outset, I'm not sure you've finished your second sentence yet, but you said that in the first sentence you wanted us to affirm the Court of Appeals, and then in your next breath, the next sentence, you said that racketeering and money laundering are, you know, part of dealing in drugs. Yet my recollection of the brief opinion of the Court of Appeals is that they didn't necessarily embrace that argument that you're making now, that the argument that racketeering and money laundering are some in some ways inherent in charges dealing with drugs. Am I correct or incorrect?
Your Honor is correct. The Court of Appeals did not explore that argument.
Did they eschew it?
I don't think they went as far as to eschew it, but they seemed perhaps
not impressed with it.
Well, skeptical.
Skeptical. That would be.
I think might
let
be better.
Me use your words. They were skeptical of the argument that you are now advancing.
Skeptical of it, and I think they also felt unnecessary to address it because they found that the order in this case, in fact, was valid because the order did not undermine the legislative purpose of providing enhanced protection from invasion of privacy relating to telephone communications. And the reason the order did not undermine that legislative purpose and the reason the order is, in fact, valid is that what we have here is a case where there was probable cause in the affidavit, in the application, to support an intercept of enumerated offenses. The only conversations of Mr. House's that were intercepted related to enumerated offenses, and the only offenses with which he was charged and of which he was convicted were enumerated offenses. In this case, on the facts of this case, the inclusion of the other offenses, even if they're deemed to not be within the umbrella of dealing of controlled substances, the inclusion of those other offenses had not a thing to do with Mr. House's conviction or with the interception of his conversations.
Mr. Colas, I'm sorry. Go ahead, just walk out.
Opposing counsel argues here that, this is the legislature was more restrictive. In fact, he even makes the argument that, this isn't just for my client, it's for other people. Your argument is that the legislative intent would allow this. Basically, you're saying that this is something that is a natural outgrowth of a wiretap, this when you find this and or other crimes. My question is this. If we were to write this case and say, all right, just on the facts here dealing with Mr. House, but limit it for further cases, would that be acceptable to the state, or are you looking at other cases also? Are you looking at the broad scope of where we're going with wiretaps?
I think, Your Honor, that it is difficult, if not impossible, in these cases to issue decisions that do not take into account the particular facts of the case presented to the court. And I think that's the weakness of saying that we're here to consider other possible factual scenarios involving these other 29 or 30 defendants. Although, of course, the court's decision has broad precedential value, but I don't think in these cases it can be divorced from the facts. And a good example of that in State versus Gilmore dealing with the sealing of search warrants, the court concluded that in that case, even though the state had violated the prohibition against disclosure of the contents of communications in its criminal complaint, that the fact was that the state had no benefit from that and no disadvantage to the defendant, and that there should not be suppression of it.
Counsel,
go ahead.
Counsel, your argument of staying with the facts of this case seems to be contrary to your legal argument of let's look at the definition of the statute and define, or let's look at the statute and define dealing in. And you have an argument the one that the Court of Appeals was skeptical of, you have an argument that we should define dealing in, it seems to me, rather broadly. And that's a matter of law, and that's for all cases. I mean, it comes to mind is a prostitution. Would that be included in dealing in drugs? And that's, if you look at the federal statute, some kind of mail fraud and stuff, is that dealing with drugs? It may or may not be. Gambling, that's listed in the federal statute, but not in this statute. Is that involving, you know, you got drugs and gambling and prostitution? It seems like, you know, almost
guns.
Yeah, that's right. So emphasizing, as you just did, stay with the facts seems to be inconsistent with the argument of define dealing in drugs in a broad sense. Can you respond to that?
Yes, Your Honor. The state is making two arguments. One is for the broader inclusion of other offenses within dealing in controlled substances. The other argument that the state is making is that, similar to what is done in a Franks case, the courts have to look at, was this a material violation? Did it really matter? And that's really something that's been followed by other courts. With respect to the first argument, there is still an element of factual determinations that have to be made. I don't think it could be said as a matter of black-letter law that dealing in controlled substances will always include racketeering. It is quite possible that someone who is dealing in controlled substances is engaging in other non-enumerated crimes which are components of racketeering. And in that case, the racketeering, unrelated to the dealing in controlled substances, I don't think would be an included offense, an enumerated offense.
So
I think there has to be
that?
A nexus between.
So what? Who decides that? The circuit court after a hearing?
I think first, if the first point of review is when the application is being prepared and reviewed by the court and the order issued. And the second one would be at a suppression hearing in the trial court to determine whether, in fact, in that case, the racketeering was sufficiently connected to dealing in controlled substances, as it is in this case where there is no other offense really that's included in this application other than possession of controlled substances with intent to deliver.
Mr. Colas, I'm always concerned about the scope of the decisions that we issue in cases. If this court were to disagree with you that the non-enumerated offenses were not contemplated by the statute, if that's the position the court takes, in this case, they were still listed in the application and they were listed in the court order. Had evidence, and I know you've argued that there, but wait a minute, there was no evidence here, but had evidence been uncovered as a result of the wiretap that went to one of those three offenses, what would the state's position be with respect to the issue of suppression? How would the state argue it then?
I think the position with respect to suppression in that circumstance would be that suppression would be a valid remedy as to the use of the evidence of those racketeering and money laundering offenses, but not as to the use of other offenses that are enumerated and for which the order was valid and there was probable cause, in effect severing that portion of the order and the evidence obtained from it.
Then do you sever the trial, too?
Well, if suppression is granted, there would be no trial on the racketeering. If suppression is not granted, then...
Well, there might be other evidence, you know... just the intercept.
If there were evidence that were admissible in the trial of one offense and inadmissible in the trial of another, the court would have to address that either through severance, depending on the nature of the case, the complexities, the number of defendants through multiple juries, or the other mechanisms that are available to the court to separate out unrelated.
Mr. Colas, do you have a sort of common sense explanation of how, as these documents were prepared, racketeering and money laundering got in both documents?
I don't have any direct personal knowledge of how money laundering got into these documents. I suspect that perhaps the origin of it is what Mr. Steinle suggests. These investigations grow out of joint investigations by state and federal authorities, and perhaps at some point they were uncertain which avenue they were going to pursue, or they are accustomed to drafting them in such a way that they include both. But that is pure speculation on my part. I don't know how these came to be drafted, and there's nothing in the record that explains that.
Mr. Colas, let's assume for a minute that the statutory scheme here is somewhat ambiguous. Is there any legislative history that might be helpful on the issue facing the court?
I did not find any legislative history that would be particularly helpful on this point. I can tell the court that this was enacted originally, 968-28 was enacted by 1969 Act 427. And the portion dealing with controlled substances at that time read dealing with narcotic drugs, and later in 1972 was changed to dealing in controlled substances, a broader term. The original legislation, AB 860 of that session that was introduced, actually enumerated certain chapters that were to be included, chapter 940, 941, 943, 945, I believe, were enumerated. During the legislative process, that enumeration of those statutes was removed, leaving us with the present language. That enumeration did not at all involve the controlled substances, or as it was then, the narcotics statute.
My understanding is that this was all occurring when Robert Warren was Attorney General, and at least some of the information that I read would indicate that he was expressing the belief that what the state was doing was tracking the federal legislation. In other words, that the intention was to cover the same things that were covered in the federal legislation. Do you have any information to that effect?
I don't have any information in terms of any writings of Attorney General Warren at the time or anything in the legislative history that I looked at that would indicate that. The courts in Wisconsin have held that, this court I think has held that we can look to the federal decisions for guidance because of the parallels between the Wisconsin statute. They're not exactly coextensive, though, and as was pointed out earlier, their structure is quite different. The federal statute, in the federal statute, they elected to go with specifying particular sections of the criminal code. In the Wisconsin statute, they chose not to, except for that computer crime, and I can't offer any clarification on that. Other states have a mix. Some states follow something more like the Wisconsin model. Other states follow more like the federal model, where they specify sections of their criminal code.
Justice Prosser, do you have a question?
I have been thinking about a statute here, 805-18, mistakes and omissions, harmless error. The court shall, in every stage of an action, disregard any error or defect in the pleadings or proceedings which shall not affect the substantial rights of the adverse party. I don't believe you cited that statute. That also goes in subsection 2 to deal with evidence. Does that statute apply or not apply? Or in effect, was there some sort of substantial effect, adverse effect on Mr. House?
I have not considered the application of that statute to the present controversy. I don't think there were any substantial rights of Mr. House that were in any way impaired. The conversations that were intercepted would have been exactly the same ones if the order had not included those two offenses. The charges against him would have been the same. The evidence against him would have been the same, and the conviction that resulted from it would have been exactly the same. So I think
what evidence would have been the same?
If
the wiretap evidence.
Right, the wiretap evidence.
That's a little prejudicial, he says, because it's the only evidence you have, he says.
I may have misspoken. I did not mean to say that there would not have been, that suppression would not benefit him, only that inclusion of the offenses in the order would not, did not affect him at all. So if inclusion of the offenses in the order is, in fact, error, it had no effect at all on Mr. House.
I would have thought you'd have answered that to say you don't go to 805.18 because the statute, 968, gives you the remedy and takes precedence over 805.18, sort of like other cases we've had where it says if the statute gives you a remedy, that's it. You don't look to substantial harm. For example, if you don't tell a defendant that he was an alien that he might be deported, the statute says, too bad. You don't, even though it's quite clear he's guilty, but you got to give him that advice. That's what I thought you'd answer.
Mr. Steinle might have answered that. I don't think so.
That's right. Maybe that's why you didn't look at 805.
Well, would it be fair to say, and I want you to be very candid, is there any evidence that the government set out to put these two or three things in the order in order to accomplish something that they shouldn't have been trying to accomplish?
I don't think so,
Your Honor. Or was it just stupidity?
I wouldn't attribute it to stupidity.
Careful.
But, no, I don't think there was any malicious intent here. They set out very clearly and in great detail the probable cause that they had to believe that these persons were involved in conspiracy to deliver controlled substances. And pretty much the application, I think it's been conceded, is limited to those kinds of offenses. So at most, I think it is superfluous language, perhaps included out of some sort of habit or misuse of a form.
Maybe that's their form language, because that would fit these federal statutes. So throw in everything in the federal statute, then just so happen they go to state courts and don't change form language.
I think that's a plausible explanation.
In your briefing, did you come up, you talk about the federal statute, and the federal statute, of course, is 18 U.S.C. 2516, I believe. And sub 1A is a veritable laundry list. I haven't counted, but scores of offenses are listed there. Everything from embezzlement from pension and welfare funds to relating to the destruction of motor vehicles or motor vehicle facilities, et cetera. I mean, there's, I don't know, 60, maybe 80, let's say 60 offenses that are listed there. I didn't see this in your briefing on either side. Sub 2 of 2516, that says, okay, state courts, you can do this too, but then limits what state courts can do to the following, which is kind of picked up by our statute. It says in sub 2, under 2516 sub 2, it starts out, the principal prosecuting attorney of any state or the principal prosecuting attorneys of any political subdivision thereof, if such attorney is authorized by a statute of that state to make application to the state court or court of competent jurisdiction. So that's the heading of sub 2. And that goes on to list then the offenses that a state can deal with. And that is when such interception may provide or has provided evidence of the commission of the offense of murder, kidnapping, gambling, robbery, bribery, extortion, or dealing in narcotic drugs, marijuana, or other dangerous drugs, or other crimes dangerous to life, limb, or property. So by federal law, it looks to me like the state is parroting the sub 2 that says, okay, we've got sub 1, this laundry list, and sub 2, this is your list, and they're parroting that list. Did you look at sub 2, and how does that play, if at all, into your argument?
Well, Your Honor, sub 2 authorizes the state legislature to adopt a statute such as 96828, and it's actually as broad or broader than the federal statute because it authorizes state legislatures to adopt statutes permitting wiretaps for any felony, crimes dangerous to life, limb, or property punishable by more than a year. That encompasses just about any sort of felony that one can imagine.
And that follows then, designated in any applicable state statute authorizing such interception. So it
correct.
Goes.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, they do have to be designated. And Wisconsin chose, Wisconsin could have adopted a statute that said any violation in chapters 940 through 946.
But they didn't.
And did not.
And they didn't designate anything other than. Later on, this computer thing,
then the stuff that's set forth in the feds, I think. I might be wrong. I didn't compare it. Offensive murder, kidnapping, gambling, robbery, bribery, extortion, or dealing in narcotic drugs, marijuana, or other dangerous drugs. And then life, limb, or other crime dangerous to life, limb, or property designated by an applicable statute authorizing such interception.
I believe that's correct.
So that's what they did. They just, you know, they just mirrored the authorization that was given to them in the federal legislation without adopting any more
computer crime.
Yeah, they did a computer crime. And they could have, as you pointed out, adopted other statutes dealing with the crime dangerous to life, limb, or property, punishable by imprisonment for more than 1 year, designated in any applicable state statute authorizing such interception, but they didn't do that.
That's correct.
Yeah. So if the feds the feds give themselves lots of things, then they have a statute that says states, you can do this. What is it? Eight or nine things you can do. If you want to do more, you can. It has to be designated an applicable state statute authorizing such interception. It doesn't look to me like we've done anything more with the exception of computer crimes.
I think that's correct. The closest related case that I could find on this question of an enumerated offense, including other offenses, is cited in my brief, U.S. versus Pacheco, a case out of the Fifth Circuit in Florida. And in that case, the court held that the Florida statute was similar to Wisconsin. It referred to gambling as a crime for which a wiretap could be obtained. Florida has no statute titled gambling. Florida's anti-gambling statutes refer to particular types of gambling activities. In the case of Pacheco, lottery, an illegal lottery that was being operated. The court held that the term gambling in that Florida statute, wiretap statute, encompassed the particular activities of operating a lottery, even though the wiretap statute did not specifically refer to Florida statute prohibiting lotteries. Similarly, in this case, we have dealing in controlled substances, which does not have a direct correspondent in any Wisconsin statute, as some other, at least one other offenses listed.
Mr. Colas, I may get assigned to write this case, and I want to know how the state wants this case written. The Court of Appeals, it seems to me, had a two-line holding. It said, given the nature of the investigation described in the application for the wiretap here, I'm reading from the last paragraph, it was highly likely that the same conversations would relate to both enumerated drug offenses and racketeering and money laundering. So you're saying, look at the application. Racketeering and money laundering would probably be in the same as the enumerated drug. Enumerated drug is okay under the state statute. Therefore, if non-enumerated offenses were included, such inclusion did not unlawfully broaden the scope of the wiretap order in this case. Very narrow.
That's correct, Your Honor.
What kind of holding do you want from this case? Now, I heard you say we can interpret it two ways. Drug offenses include, and then you can have a whole lot of things they include, but you, too, want to look at the facts of the particular case, as I understand it.
That's correct.
Or you say it can be much broader than that. You want it narrower than that. What kind of, if you had to write the case, what would you say?
I think if I were writing the case, I would say that there are circumstances in which the phrase dealing in controlled substances can include other offenses when those other offenses are committed in furtherance of dealing in controlled substances, or when dealing in controlled substances is a constituent or predicate offense of the other offense that's listed in the order. And second, I think I would hold that in the case a non-enumerated offense is included, or even if the offense was not an enumerated offense, that a court ruling on suppression should look to determine whether the inclusion of the enumerated offense was material to the issuance of the order or to the evidence that was obtained, and whether it in fact had any effect on the parties, whether the error was such that it actually threatened to undermine the protection that the statute affords to the privacy of communications.
So you've got a twofold holding. One, dealing in drugs is broad, but you have to look at the facts of the particular case. So it could include racketeering, could include money laundering, it could include guns, it could include prostitution, depending on the facts of the case. And two, even if you don't pass that test, the state doesn't pass that test, if you don't use the evidence of racketeering, guns, money laundering, prostitution, and et cetera, then it's okay.
If the order was otherwise, as in this case, had sufficient probable cause of other enumerated.
That.
Correct.
Okay, one, read the order broadly, read the application broadly. Two, depending on the facts. Two, even if you can't do that, if the government isn't using that evidence in the case, it's okay. No harm.
Correct.
Mr. Colas, you have, in your brief, argued, and I don't know if we're going to get to this or not, but I want to be ready for it, but you've argued that we should apply, if necessary, a good faith exception based on the officer's following of the order that was before it. And I know you've listed cases in both directions. You've cited two cases, two jurisdictions, I believe, California and Florida, that you indicate have not extended good faith in wiretap situations. Are you aware of any other jurisdictions that have refused to go that far?
That refused to go that far?
Correct.
No. In the brief, I cited Louisiana as a case, as a state in which they did adopt the good faith extension. I'm not aware of other jurisdictions that have explicitly refused to adopt a good faith.
Remind me about Leon. Was that good faith because of probable cause being the defect?
Yes, Your Honor. It had to do with the sufficiency of the affidavit, I believe.
Here, on the face of this, there's a legal defect. What does good faith apply where on the face of the application or the warrant is a legal defect? The legal defect being here that you got a non-statutory enumerated two crimes.
Louisiana held that though it was a legal defect, a good faith exception should apply because the purpose of even the statutory exclusionary rule would not be furthered by granting suppression in those cases.
As a general rule, has Leon been interpreted that broadly, or is it sticking to probable cause?
I think as a general rule, I cannot say that it's been interpreted that broadly.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Colas? Thank you, Mr. Colas. Mr. Steinle?
Please, the court.
How would you write the opinion?
I would write the opinion, Your Honor, that in this case, Judge Sullivan did not have the authority to authorize non-enumerated crimes, and therefore the order itself is a void order. He had no authority to do it.
How would the officers know that?
Well, it's in actually, you asked that in Leon, too. This isn't officers, Your Honor. This has to do with, again, as I indicated, is these are U.S. attorneys, district attorneys, everybody on these forces. These Title III's are not
officers. Towards
the
application, but then there's the enforcement part.
Correct, but those are all supervised by lawyers on a daily basis. They have to sign off on the logs. So the lawyers are intimately involved in this. And to apply, and before I get to that, before I apply Leon says, okay, when the officers are acting in good faith, Title III, all the way through from start to finish, has lawyers all over it from start to finish. So that's why, at least as a practical matter, I'm asking the court not to apply Leon, even if it gets to that. But the question arose when Mr. Colas was up is that was this just shoddy legal work on behalf of the prosecutors that they cut and pasted something and threw it into state court? And I say no, because...
But, counsel, let me just... I'm just reading from the red brief, page 14 and 15, and the argument is made, this is as far as Eason, and you made this argument that in addition, the process used in obtaining the warrant must include significant investigation and review by either police officer trained and knowledgeable in probable cause requirements or knowledgeable government attorneys. You made the argument, look, these are very knowledgeable government attorneys. Isn't the issue of good faith is, look, the contemplation here that officers going out and executing this and bringing this evidence, they probably or did not even look at, quote, racketeering, money laundering. They were looking at controlled substance. That's what your client was dealing with. So why shouldn't we use the Eason good faith in this case?
Because exactly what I said is that I think that good faith has to do with the probable cause of the officers, for the most part, bringing the, if you will, the an affidavit for a search warrant and then later getting the search warrant and relying upon that in good faith. It's the officers, so the attorneys are out of it. And for the most part, the officers are the one that are drafting those documents. In this case, that's not true. But if I can just get...
Sure. Well,
to answer your question, though, is they were looking for that. You said that you read this affidavit in support of it. The attachment A specifically says, is on attachment A, they have the chart of Sammy Caraballo on the top, and then on the left side, on page 51 of my appendix, they're looking specifically at five people for money laundering under the federal statute. So to sit there and say that, oh, this is just shoddy work and we're cutting and pasting, no, they said it right in there and they diagram. And then on page 53, they have a conspiracy, again, diagrammed on 53 in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 businesses that they're looking at for the federal laundering statute. So to sit there and say we were ignoring that or we weren't looking for evidence, of course they were. They put it right in their attachments, and they even drew a picture for the judge saying we're looking for money laundering in violation of 18 United States Code 1957.
But in the information, which lists all the defendants, nobody was charged with racketeering or money laundering.
I understand that nobody was charged, but to say that they weren't seeking that information is right there. They drew a picture for the judge and saying, look, at we think that this person is laundering his money through these six businesses, and we want to obtain evidence with regard to that. So to sit there and to say that, oh, we just threw it together and that was an afterthought, no, they specifically said in both diagrams and in actually the affidavit, they're saying that Sammy Caraballo is laundering his proceeds through these things to do legitimate things. So it's right there. They're asking for investigative tools to research or to investigate something that is not enumerated to do. So thank you very much.
One question. Justice Prosser.
Are you related to Roland Steinle?
I am. Roland was on the court, obviously. He was my grandfather. And then Roland Jr. is my father. Roland Third's my brother, so.
Rolling.
A lot of Rolands.
Well, welcome.
I'm the youngest of the Steinleys. They say the best of all. How was that?
Good answer. That concludes our hearing in 05 AP 2202 CR, State versus Jeffrey A. House. And I want to thank Attorney Steinle and Colas for